afternoon, everybody. I just want to say I was initially trained in North America, our home of the turkey. I'm interested in the archaeology of poultry husbandry and what paleopathology can say about human-poultry relationships. So I'm here today to welcome you all to the wonderful world of the domestic turkey. One of my long-term research obsessions, but by no means the only one. I'll start off with a bit about the archaeological interpretations of the turkey, what they have been like, and the change in my perception of the bird during this research. And then I'll provide a little bit of ethnographic and historical background on turkeys and their feathers, and then I'll return to the archaeology and pathologies. So it took a really long time for archaeologists working in the American Southwest to even accept the turkeys were a domestic species prior to the arrival of Europeans. Turkey bones recovered from prehistoric sites in the American Southwest have overwhelmingly been interpreted as discard from the eating of turkey meat. And amongst the numbers and formulae presented in formal bone reports from the region, analysts regularly present the estimated meat weight of the bones represented, including in at least one case I read the meat weight of a golden eagle. So all this despite the very clear primacy of birds symbolically in rock art and on ceramics, to say nothing of the products of avians apart from their flesh or any suggestion of their role apart from meat production. I think that the reason for this is that the archaeological remains of the turkey being interpreted in this way is that the current perceptions of the species have coloured the way people have viewed the past at various times. So turkeys are currently often categorised as these meaty objects of derision, and it's possible that this has been projected backward through time. This is a bit of a big deal in archaeology more broadly, but for the moment, let's discard kind of all of these impressions of the turkey as irascible, greedy, stupid, you know, it'll drown in less than an inch of water, and consider Çağatay-Ötülen, the turkey god. Aren't these fabulous? These are from various Mesoamerican codices, and they depict Çağatay-Ötülen, which is an Aztec deity, and a very powerful one at that. So, the turkey god was connected to the concepts of disease, plague, and purification. One gets the impression that suffering from an unknown illness would certainly merit the specialist attention of this deity. The name is translated both as the jeweled bird and the precious night turkey. And Çağatay-Ötülen is basically an avatar, an ahwayi, of Tezcatlipoca, who's up top here. Tezcatlipoca is the lord of the smoking mirror. He's a chthonic deity. He's associated with the colour black in the material of obsidian, and also with the jaguar. And his opposite, his rival, is Quetzalcoatl, associated with the sky, the colour turquoise, and macaws and serpents. So there's you know, I hadn't anticipated that there was a turkey god when I started this research. I was shocked when I learned about it. And I hadn't realised how deeply embedded it was in this sort of, one of the main pivot points of the dualistic worldview, when you're talking about the pantheon. So, also surprisingly, Ötülen is often used as part of the honorific. That's a hen turkey. And I was really surprised by that, because I often think of, if you're going to think of the turkey as a spectacular thing, you think of the male turkey strutting and fanning his tail and looking quite, you know, a bit silly, but magnificent in his own way. But the hen turkey can be just pitch black. We might think that's not very interesting, but Tezcatlipoca might find that more suitable as an avatar, as a skin to wear. I'm just postulating. Right, so the turkey was also, I missed this one thing. I just want to say that this idea of a skin, this is from the Codex Borbonicus, so I wanted to call your attention to that quickly. Right, further north, the turkey is still really important to the peoples of the American Southwest. There are certainly cultural and linguistic connections between the regions. I'm not a linguist, but hearing kind of native speakers say Shapup for a connection to the underworld and Shabulba for the underworld, I kind of think, gosh, they sound awfully similar. I haven't perceived that. Maybe I should. But among the Hopi, there's a Hopi kachina called Khoyona. Kachina are effectively, they have three parts. They have a spirit, and then they are when they are danced. Somebody dancing a kachina will say they're dancing with a friend. And then there's these dolls, which are cradle dolls, which are, you know, often used to sort of introduce children to the idea of, you know, particular kachina. There's Zuni fetishes. They do have religious importance to some people, but they're sold often as objects of art in their own right. And the turkey, in modern times, is not a terribly common subject for any of these things. But that's kind of another story, perhaps. There's also a Zuni clan called the Tonakwe, and they are the turkey people. So, apart from the symbolic importance of the turkey, explorers, colonists, and ethnographers have documented and described the use of turkey feathers by First Nations people across the New World for a spectrum of purposes. So turkey feather robes and other items of clothing were really widely used until the turkey was nearly driven to extinction. At about the same time as the passenger pigeon, people started thinking, maybe we should not possibly do this anymore. This is W. Langdon Keene's interpretation of what Pocahontas would have looked like, and she wears a turkey feather robe. Turkey feather fans, that's a 19th century fan, were made in the style of European ladies' fans. And prayer sticks are still made using turkey feathers today, along with other items of regalia and sort of objects of devotion. The feather distribution project now, current day, still works with 29 of 31 Pueblo villages to ensure that they have enough feathers for religious purposes, and turkey feathers are part of that exchange. Although the Spanish colonial sources are really very revealing, much of the information on the use of turkey feathers and the ways in which turkeys and humans interacted from European contact onward come from 19th century ethnography. At Zuni, Frank Hamilton Cushing wrote, "When I first went to live with the Zunis, their sheep were plucked, not sheared, with flat strips of band iron in place of the bone spatulae originally used in plucking the turkeys. And the herders always scrupulously picked it up, calling it down, not hair, not fur, and spinning it, knitting too, with their long woolen leggings as they followed their sheep, all as their forefathers ever used to pick up and twirl the stray feathers and knit at their down kilts and tunics as they followed and herded their turkeys." Alexander Stephen, who the only thing we know about him is that he studied at Edinburgh, it's kind of sad. He was at Hopi, which is an even more kind of difficult pueblo to access. He wrote, "Kakpati took the Northwest prayer sticks, that is all of the prayer sticks made by those in Kiva today, to be deposited for them, but not at a spring. I must say as to this again. If there had been more turkey feathers, there would have been more prayer sticks made. I gave them a note yesterday to get some turkey feathers from TVK. Is it possible they depend on this supply? This cannot be, for they have turkeys here on the mesa. But this is what they say, they have no turkey. Further talk elicits the fact that the turkeys have already been plucked here, plucked bare of all the kinds of feathers appropriate for prayer stick trimming." The problem with using these observations, about, aside from the typical caveats of observation and biases, is that things change. On the right side of the slide, we have a picture of Zuni dancers. They're doing a dance called the Turkey Dance in a really wonderful place called Chaco Canyon. And observers have found this event very special because here are Pueblo dancers, here at an amazing ancestral Pueblo site, doing a dance they have done for pretty much ever. But others would contend that we cannot possibly know that for sure, that we can't actually know these things about the past, because after all, the Zuni now have a katsina called kawako, the chicken. And since the chicken was introduced by Europeans, surely kawako isn't a real katsina. Things change. But although this is a really inelegant way of putting it, everything does come from somewhere. So, turning to the archaeology, as one might imagine, feathers don't preserve terribly well under a number of circumstances, but the conditions at some sites in the American Southwest are really very excellent for organics. And here are a few good examples of weaving and parts of objects. These are both parts of turkey feather robes, and we've got a sash on the right. There's also documented instances of hundreds of desiccated turkey corpses being recovered from dry cave sites, and they've been penned in and for whatever reason never let out again. Yeah, sadly, no repositories saw fit to kind of keep these little dry turkey mummies. They do keep really splendid sashes like this. This contains sort of flicker feathers and macaw feathers, but the fabulousness of the turkey is not something that was really connected to the little dry turkey mummies, sadly. I don't have any pictures of examples of archaeological prayer sticks, but it's something I'm on the lookout for, and maybe there's a repository somewhere in the Southwest that's got one. Domestic turkey bones make up a large percentage of animal remains that are excavated from prehistoric sites in the American Southwest. Across the sites I looked at for this research, an average of 15% of all of the bones, sometimes as high as 30%, were from turkeys in the assemblage. These figures may well be a bit low compared to the number of turkeys moving about on the past landscape, because they don't take into account animals like deer that have larger, more survivable bones, or the loss of tiny little turkey bones, which is, you know, quite easy to accomplish. Domestication and what it actually means for an animal to be tame or domestic or commensal or somewhere in between is a really hot topic in archaeology as much as it is anywhere. With regard to turkeys, the trend seems to be that the early 20th century archaeological literature assumed that they weren't at all domestic and they were just kept captive by the first peoples of the New World, and perhaps they were tamed beasts by the 70s onward. They were interpreted as recent domesticates then brought in from... They might have been domesticated early, but they were brought in from somewhere more civilized, like Mesoamerica. We now know from ancient DNA and other studies that there were probably several centers of turkey domestication, and one of them may very well have been in the American Southwest. The genetic makeup of these domestic turkeys includes subspecies that are not endemic to the American Southwest, so that also suggests a bit of moving around and mixing, certainly people talking to each other in different regions and involving turkeys. As anyone who keeps turkeys might tell you, they're not the easiest animals to control or house. They're very inquisitive, they're very curious, they can be quite destructive in their habits. There are a number of possibilities from the archaeological record for how people dealt with this. Turkeys on tethers are depicted on ceramics. Stone, puddled adobe and dry cave turkey pens with very deep dung deposits have been excavated. So objects also suggest that some birds were transported in large baskets that would have been strapped to one's back. If you can imagine having a basket of turkey balls on your back walking around in the desert, might be a bit uncomfortable for everybody. Anyway, at the bottom of the slide are some turkey pens from a site called Pakime in Chihuahua, and these exist in the northern regions as well, not with the same morphology. For a long time, turkey diet was presumed to be mainly maize. It's been suggested that they ate insects and thus were probably used as a form of pest control in fields. But others pointed out that if people were living such a nasty, brutish and short life, surely they would rather eat the maize than let the turkeys eat it. And then there was a consideration, well, maybe turkeys were used to convert the corn into protein for human consumption. Some isotopic investigation has been done on this, and there's ongoing broader scale research in the work, and I really look forward to seeing what it indicates. My skeletal research suggests that some directed breeding was going on, but that the results are not what would be anticipated if the turkey was solely or even mainly a meat product. If so, there are multiple other studies on other avian species that are considered to be poultry that demonstrate a certain size and morphology changes in the bone, size and shape changes that would happen if the turkeys were being bred for meat. Additionally, I had really low percentages of juvenile birds, something I would expect to see if turkeys were, you know, a meat source. Even wild turkeys reach maximum weight before they reach skeletal maturity. So I think that in that case, feather colour and quality were probably really important attributes in turkey breeding. My metrical results suggest a bottleneck, but not in the direction of turkeys for meat. A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away, I undertook archaeological fieldwork at an ancestral Pueblo site called the Bluff Great House. It's pictured here after being backfilled 8 weeks in the searing summer heat of Utah. And that was it, archaeology for me. I mean, wow, I absolutely loved it. But this map is just for reference. We have sort of the Bluff Grain House at the top. These are other sites with pathologies and that I mentioned in the talk, and down here is Pakime that had those turkey pens from the previous slide. Bluff was excavated for several seasons, and then I was asked to do the faunal analysis. So go through all of the animal bones and say what species they were, how many give bone counts and look at percentages and things like that. I quickly came across a number of pathologies, and I thought, "Oh, what's this?" And I was discouraged from pursuing them. I found these two ulnae, which are from the same archaeological context. That means they're quite likely from the same place and time, and they're really... I've lost my place. Right. Basically, what these are is a couple of compound fractures with some evidence of infection. The ends of the bones are gone, but it's probably a left and a right ulna. And I spent a lot of time trying to figure out an explanation for the pathologies at this site, and I pretty quickly figured out that it wasn't likely to be the result of dog attacks or male-male competition, but actually it had something to do with something else, which I was encouraged to class very vaguely as human behaviour, and leave it at that. I could talk about those all day, anyway, those are the bluff ulnae that kind of started off this whole track. What I did next for my PhD was I analysed or reanalysed domestic turkey bones from 8 further sites across the American Southwest, with the goal of describing and perhaps using differential diagnosis on the pathologies that were present. My supervisor and I were concerned the bluff was maybe a fluke, you know, maybe there's not pathologies described very often in the Southwestern archaeological literature, because there really just aren't very many, or they might be too subtle to identify. But I found pathologies in every assemblage that I studied, and most of these had not been described previously. I found that the ulnae were one of the most pathological elements and was the most frequently affected by trauma. All of these on this slide bear some evidence of trauma. Some of these lesions are fractures, some of them are very well healed, and some of them are spectacularly necrotic or infected. So what happened to these domestic turkey ulnae across the American Southwest? Well, I think that those traumatic injuries in the two previous slides might well be the result of turkeys being plucked for their feathers whilst still alive. I'm sorry about the wing, I know it's grim. They were possibly kept to be repeatedly harvested when the need arose, or maybe even seasonally, like shearing sheep. There is a seasonal religious calendar, so it might have been connected to some form of that. Here's a turkey wing. You have the nice symmetrical secondary feathers here. Those are the ones that attach to the ulna, kind of directly, which is, you know, above, which is the radius along the front line of the wing. There are really good reasons to pluck feathers. Turkeys don't lose all of their feathers in one go, and when they do lose feathers, they're going to be kind of ragged and have somewhat outlived their usefulness. Additionally, the oral histories do suggest that feathers from specific areas of the turkey body were needed for some purposes. Thigh feathers for a prayer stick to be buried near a field boundary, perhaps, or maybe a lovely striped secondary wing feather for a smudge fan. When the feather leaves the turkey, a new one starts to regrow immediately, and the process can possibly begin anew. I might be the only person to seriously put forward the idea of harvested turkey feathers, you know, hand-harvested turkey feathers. I'm not the only person who's noted trauma in turkey ulnae from sites in the American Southwest. In the centre of the slide, an ulna with extensive sort of periosteal new bone formation is shown, and that's quite likely in response to trauma. There's a normal one here for comparison. That's from Pueblo Bonito, which is one of the largest and most impressive Chaco and grain houses. I mentioned Chaco Canyon earlier with those Zuni dancers doing the turkey dance. This is one, just one of 22 grain houses in this canyon. Go to Chaco Canyon, it's amazing. This is the outside, this is the inside of Pueblo Bonito. Definitely worth seeing, especially if you're in the area. This 1960s kind of black and white image over there is from a site called Seitara in Arizona, and that's, you know, definitely traumatic injury. We've also got really proliferate response to trauma in a coracoid there as well, but I had to narrow my talk. Right, so Zuni has what people like to call a Cinderella story about a very poor young girl without a name. She's always just the turkey girl, and it's implied that the people who herd turkeys are not the owners of the birds, but they're destitute, that they often have no family. They wear rags, and they sometimes live in sort of the same space as the bird. And the turkey girl herds the turkeys like sheep across the land. She pens them up at night where she lives outside the village. Because you don't want, you know, the ragged people or the turkeys inside the village. That would just be too much trouble. There's going to be a big feasting dance, and it's really not the sort of thing that the poor people outside the village attend. But the turkeys love their turkey girl, and they agree to work transformative magic and get her into the party. She can wear their splendor for an evening and become a bit like them. But she has to promise to return and release them from their pen at dawn so that they can go and forage. seems pretty reasonable. She gets to wear that glamour of the turkeys for an evening and is transformed. But as you might imagine, the story doesn't end quite as tightly as the Disney Cinderella. And the turkey girl so enjoys wearing that beauty that she breaks her promise to the turkeys. And in the story, there's possible connections to be drawn about past turkey management, maybe about status and turkey keeping, perhaps about gender and animal-human relationships. But what really struck me is the impact of the turkey girl's failure to look after the birds at the end of the story. Not only do her turkeys vanish, but it's far wider than that. For all time, humans would no longer be able to talk to the other animals and would feel alone in the universe. So, thank you all very much.